Around Comics, episode 61. Chicago, this is Around Comics, a roundtable discussing topics in and around the world of comics. I'm your host, Christopher Niesman, and I'm joined, as always, by my partner in crime and the co-host of Around Comics, Mr. Brian Salazar.
Hello, hello.
And next is the man who brings the funny and the beer. He is our other co-host, Mr. Tom Caters.
I expect to be reimbursed for both. What funny and beer?
What price do you put on funny, Tom?
You can't.
It's priceless.
It's priceless. The beer cost $8.96.
All right, well, gentlemen, welcome aboard. Thank you to everyone for listening to another Thursday edition of Around Comics. It's not very often that you get to talk with a true legend in the comics industry, but that's exactly what we're going to be doing today. In just a couple minutes, will be our pleasure to welcome Mr. Gentleman Gene Colan to the program. But first, I'd like to let you know that this episode of Around Comics is sponsored by the New York Comic Con.
The New York Comic Con is bigger, better, and has doubled the space with more gaming and anime for 2007. Come to the Jacob Javits Center February 23rd through 25th and experience the biggest pop culture event in New York City, featuring comics, anime, manga, graphic novels, video games, trading card games, RPG, MMOs, toys, movies, TV, celebrities, and more. Guests of honor include Stan Lee, Jeff Smith, J. Michael Straczynski, and George Perez, with many more to be announced. For a complete list of guests, as well as show and advance ticket information, visit www.nycomiccon.com. Don't miss out on the 2007 New York Comic Con, or you will be chastised by your quote unquote friends.
And when you're there, come and visit us in the Podcaster Alley. We will be there.
Yes.
Laugh at us.
And if you're not going to be in New York at the end of February, but you live in the Chicago area, I'd like you to know that Around Comics is recorded every Friday at 7 o'clock at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles, located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you're in the area, please drop by. We would love to meet you. When you're here, remember to ask about Dark Tower's Pull List membership. It's one of the best you'll find anywhere. Dark Tower has a great selection of mainstream comics, indie comics, and trades, as well as statues and action figures. Come to Dark Tower for all of your comics and collectibles needs.
And remember that your Around Comics experience isn't complete until you've read this week's Long Box of Love. Each Thursday episode of Around Comics has a wonderfully handcrafted webcomic from Brian Bowles. Check it out every Thursday at www.aroundcomics.com.
You guys read his long box this week?
I did.
I'm waiting for the trade. I can never remember what happened in the previous weeks.
Striking Peter Parker penis.
Peter Parker? Peter Parker's
Peter? I thought
Peter.
It would be
the spectacular, as
the
I call it.
Spectacular spider penis.
Yeah. Not so spectacular, unfortunately.
Giant
so,
spider balls.
Thank you, as always, Brian Bowles. Gene Colan started working in comics in 1944, and over 60-plus years has become a legend in the comics industry. He's helped define some of comics' most cherished characters and properties. Whether you know his work from Iron Man, Captain America, Howard the Duck, Doctor Strange, The Tomb of Dracula, Daredevil, or countless others, his style and skill are unmistakable. A 2005 inductee into the Will Eisner Hall of Fame and one of the true gentlemen of comics, Around Comics, is pleased to welcome Mr. Gene Colan. Mr. Colan, welcome to Around Comics, and thank you for being on the show.
Thank you very much for asking me. I find this occasion very enlightening and important to me.
Well, we'll see how you feel.
Yeah, are you interviewing us, or are we interviewing you now?
I'm enjoying every bit of it, so.
Excellent. Well, Mr. Colan, looking back at your long career and the sheer volume of work that you've done, I guess the best place to start is at the beginning. And can you tell us how you got into comics and a little bit of what the comics industry was like whenever you broke in?
Well, around 45, 46. And my I always knew I wanted to get into comics. But even prior to that, prior to getting into the service, way back, I mean, 11, 10, 11, 12, I was always fooling around with a hero, a sort of a superhero that I had invented. Not a superhero, but a spy, and I called him Jim Turner, American Spy, and I entertained myself hour upon hour with drawing this thing, and I was highly influenced by film, because in those days, very few films came out in Technicolor, so 98% of them were black and white, and sort of pretend, since I was too young to go into the service, that I was actually there, and I lived all those heroic moments with the character that I had created. So that sort of started me off. I would go to the stationery store and buy a pad for about a half an hour, a quarter, who knows, it was next to nothing in those days. And I began. It had no lines on it, and just plain white sheets of paper, and I started to put in the panels and make up my own stories, pretending that I was actually living the adventure, and I would while away the time that way. I was not, I didn't mix it up very much. I was sort of a loner, although I did play with the other guys in front of the building that I lived in. I still preferred drawing and sketching and doing all that sort of thing. And that was really my very that was the beginnings of my interest in comics.
I imagine you as the type of person that always had a pencil and a pad of paper with you, kind of wherever you went.
Always. Now I remember doing something pretty nasty in the confines of my family. My mother, when I was very young, knew that the quickest way to punish me, and the best way, would be to take my pencil and paper away. And so she would do that. She would say, okay, yeah, you're going to be a wise guy, now you're going to pay for it, and you're not allowed to draw for a week. That was almost impossible for me to do. So when she was not looking, out would come the pad and pencil.
Draw with rocks, so, if you had to.
I would have, at threat of life and limb, I would have done it just like I did it then.
Now, you enlisted in the Marines originally during World War II?
Yes, I tried to get into the Marine Corps, and my father came down and got wind of it, and I told him. And he says he went down to the enlistment station and told him that I was underage, and I was. And so they released me.
But you did end up going...
I got into the Air Force, yeah, I did.
And
I did everything but fly.
And you were stationed in the Philippines, correct?
Yes.
And there was a time there that you worked for the Manila Press?
I worked for the Manila... long after, I was overseas in the Philippines for quite some time, and then I got the idea of maybe getting... some of my work into the Manila Times. That was the big newspaper there in the Philippines, in Manila. Manila was basically made up of craters and, you know, shell craters and bullet holes everywhere. It was a mess. But I did get work from them, quite a bit of it. And I actually made more money from them than I did from Uncle Sam. So I enjoyed that. I really did.
Now, was that strip work? Was that more...
No, I had a running diary of my experiences in the service, all in the form of cartooning.
Wow.
Highly influenced by Kniff. I sort of patterned my style after him, at least as close as I thought I could ever get. And I would just keep a running diary from day to day as to what happened. Each day that passed, and would do it in the form of course, in the form of drawing. I managed to get into special service when I was overseas. I tried everything in the book to get into special service, but each soldier had a what they called an MOS number, and once that was given to you, you could never change it. So they told me. And I was trying to get out of it the worst way, and everybody in my unit knew that's exactly what I was trying to do. And one day they rounded up a lot of guys and wanted to know, it was the main question that they asked everyone, what they would do if a Japanese prisoner ever escaped. And when the time came to me and they said, what would you do, Regine? Would you just let him go or what? Because you've got to remember, if he escapes, you have to serve his time. And I said, it didn't matter to me about that. I would just simply, I wouldn't shoot him, if that's what you're asking. I'd let him go. And that did it. They got me right out of... I was a prison chaser at that time, sitting on top of a garbage truck with a carbine and making sure that the prisoners would do what they had to do during the day. And I would have done anything to get out of that. And so that's how I got out of it.
I thought you were going to say that you told him that you can make a really great drawing of that Japanese soldier running away. Exactly what happened.
Well, Gene, at that time, and I know that a lot of servicemen read comic books. Were those, I mean, were you keeping up with what the industry was doing while you were in the service? No?
No, not at all, no. I just simply took advantage of where I was, and it was just a mecca for information as subject matter. Mm-hmm. There's so much subject matter. I would draw the Japanese prisoners. I would, if we had a shutdown zero on the field, I drew that. I even got inside of I think it was a Mustang fighter, and pretending, we're looking at the instrument panel, and I said, my God, you'd have to be a walking encyclopedia in order to run this thing. And so I sketched the entire layout of the, dashboard. Every number, every switch, everything. And then I noticed that sitting in this plane that I was sitting awfully low, I could hardly look out the front window. I said, how the hell do these pilots, fly this thing? And I noticed the seat that I was sitting in, it had a big hole in it. A huge hole. It was a metal seat. But I had no padding and nothing. It was just a big hole, and my butt was resting right into the hole, which didn't give me any height. And then I realized later that it was, if I had been a pilot, I would have been sitting on my parachute.
Oh, okay.
So that would have made the difference. But it was great. I just enjoyed myself overseas. There were some rough moments, but I did fine.
Well, once you got out, I mean, you knew at that moment, I mean, you knew you wanted to work in comics. So tell us a little bit about once you were out of the service and how you started to get into drawing comics professionally.
Prior to going into the service, I spent a summer working for Fiction House. They were on, I think, 53rd, or I think that was the street, and right off Fifth Avenue. And I spent an entire summer there with one of the other artists, Murphy Anderson.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, the two of us, we were working there. And then, of course, when that was over, when the summer ended, then I went into the service.
But once you got out of the service, then you started...
I couldn't get that job back. I tried. I even wrote a letter.
Well, I've read that whenever you came out of the service that you really wanted to work for DC. What was the big draw about DC at that time?
Well, I did have they allowed me before I went into the service, when I was just a kid again, they saw that I had some potential, and they were very nice. They took me through the bullpen, and I met Bob Kane there, and actually saw how comics were done, and I never realized that. I mean, my presentation to DC as to what I was capable of was just drawn on a very small pad, even smaller than the comic book itself. And I never realized that any of this stuff was ever done with a brush or anything else. I worked with a nickel pen that you'd buy in a candy store and to ink some of it. And the pictures were about the size of a panel was about the size of a postage stamp. Well, when I got over to D.C., I saw, really, my eyes just dropped to the ground. I couldn't believe it. I saw a lot of Jack Kirby's work, which just blew me away. I saw it all in pencil, and I knew that I had my hands full, that I would really have to go back to school, which was what they advised me to do.
Was Jack working on, I mean, he had a reputation for working on really large artboard at that time, right?
Very stiff, thick boards. And I did. I just simply went home immediately, got myself went to an art store and bought some of that kind of that illustration board and just simply would do the same thing. I would draw line for line what Jack did to try to get the feel of what really good work was like, and if it meant tracing it, I would have done it. And that's how I did it. That's how I just went back. I went back to school. I got in. When I got out of the service, I went to the Art Students League immediately and spent maybe 2 years or so, year and a half there. And I got to understand something about anatomy, which I knew nothing at all about. And overseas, I met a fellow by the name of Stephen Kidd. I don't know if you know that name. Is that familiar with, mm-hmm. with any of you? But he saw the potential. He was a fabulous illustrator. He worked for the government, and he did a lot of beautiful paintings of Korean life. And I just couldn't believe what I saw. And I knew I was up against some big-time illustrators.
Now, you went to school on the GI Bill. Is that correct?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yep.
Now, whenever you came out, you ended up going to Timely. Can you tell us a little bit?
Eventually, I went to Timely, yeah. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get the first place with DC, not even after school. I went back to them again, but I couldn't get anywhere. So I simply thumbed through the various comic books, and on the front page or the inside cover there would be a listing of where they were, you know, and who the editor was and so on. And I just went right up cold to, in fact, I spent about a week doing a war story at home. I just put in everything but the kitchen sink in it. I inked it, at first I penciled it, then I inked it, and I even put a wash effect over everything. And I also wrote it. I mean, there wasn't much in the writing. It was just more of the drawing that I was trying to impress somebody with. And I went up to a Timely Comics. Marvel was called Timely Comics then. And a man by the name of Martin Goodman. Are you familiar with that name?
I was going to ask you if you had the opportunity to meet him.
Oh, yes, I did. I mean, I would see him in a hall or something in passing. I never really spoke to him that much. Well, that's how I met Stan.
Yeah.
But anyway, I came up off the elevator with the artwork and the art director. Came right out and took a look at me at the work, and he said to me, you have time, just wait here for a minute. And I knew right away, that the radar went up immediately when he said, can you wait here a minute? That gave it away, and I said, oh boy, they must be interested. And he was gone for about 10 minutes, and that made it even better. when he came back out, he asked me in to meet Stan, and that's when I met Stan. Stan, we're not exactly the same age, but pretty damn close. I'm 80, and he's 83.
Mm-hmm.
So he was just a kid himself at the time, just like me. He was wonderful. And so he said to me, so you want to be in comics, eh? That's what he said. And we started to talk, and he said, would you like a job? And I said, yeah. He says, well, you got it. just how he talked. He always reminded me of Jack Lemmon. I don't know why. Maybe it's his boyish way, but that's who he reminded me. And I got myself my. That was my start.
To give us just a little perspective, maybe. I mean, at the time, I mean, we hear names like, you know, Bob Kane and Jack Kirby and Stan Lee.
Ooh,
and to us, they're legends in this industry, obviously. But at the time, you know, did you know of these guys before meeting them?
No. None of them. No, I didn't. I didn't know who they were. I didn't know anyone, but not a soul in the business, no. I just went up cold. I just knew what I wanted to do, loving film and all. That was my biggest influence, was motion pictures.
It's interesting that you're talking about your time spent in the military and doing war books. Did you think there was definitely an advantage to having been in the military in drawing a war book? Was there a lot of translation from experience?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everything in life that you see, to an artist, he uses. He can't resist it. If he sees something unusual, he goes out of his way to use it, you know? That's what helps form a style, really. It's just a constant search for something. And you don't quite, you're not aware of a style. It just comes upon you suddenly. It's like handwriting, really. You know, you're not aware much of your handwriting. It just will write out your name. And that's and this is what I think artists do. They may all start out thinking that they can control a style, but I don't think that you really can.
You end up with bad handwriting or bad drawing. No.
I got a lot of, Stan was wonderful to me. He really was.
You were a staff artist then at that point, correct, with Timely?
Right, but in the bullpen. Mm-hmm. I met a lot of people. I met Sid Shores. Do you know who he is?
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I met him. He was, speak of him highly enough. He helped me a lot. He was in charge of the bullpen. Then eventually I met John Buscema, who I thought was just out of this world. And right to the very end of his life, I felt the same way about his work. If I knew his work was being shown somewhere, I'd really take a good hard look at it, because I was influenced a lot by him.
Well, he was fantastic.
Yeah.
Yes, he was. What a craftsman. He did a lot of work, too, in advertising. So he was really, I think, ahead of most of us. He was a natural.
So in the beginning, then, what kind of books were you working on with Stan?
Everything. Crime stories, westerns, all that stuff. Got a lot of help from Sid with the westerns, because he was great at it. I had a crime story to do once, I remember, and there was one of the panels had a woman sitting in front of a mirror putting on makeup, and no matter how I tried, I knew it was all wrong, and I couldn't make it look natural and right. And the next day I came in with, I was actually working on a freelance level 2 at home with all the work I could get from Marvel, and I just couldn't do this particular shot, so I came in and asked him about it. He showed me in 5 seconds where I went wrong, and whipped that in there so fast, and I learned a lot. See, that's so helpful to one. Usually artists are very helpful to one another, you know. They're very giving.
But at the same time, you kind of always wanted to work for DC, too, and then it was about...
Yeah, but when I saw that it just wasn't going to happen, I got in with Marvel. I was very happy there. I was just interested in basically getting work. I thought that DC, and not knowing any better, I thought that DC was the MGM of comics, you know? Batman was quite popular at the time. Superman was, of course, very popular. And these are properties that DC owned. And I wanted to be a part of it.
Sure.
So I figured, my God, if I could get a job there, I'd be in. You know, that came out of my head, a thought that I thought was something I needed. I needed for myself to try and get a position there. But it just didn't work out. So I did it with Marvel. Now they had a good run of characters too. You know, they had Iron Man and several other things. The Two Gun Kid, Kid Colt, and some other Captain America. I think Sid Shores did a lot of the Captain America stories.
I think Marvel turned out okay in the end.
Oh yeah, they did. certainly did look at what's happening to them today.
Well, around 1950, you did go to work for DC, though, on Hopalong Cassidy, is that right?
That was DC, yeah. I, eventually, you know, I got work from them. I really did. I got a lot of war stories from them. And then Hopalong Cassidy came along. And Julie Schwartz was my editor on that.
We had read that when you were working the Hopalong Cassidy, that you were actually using film cells to base some of your drawings on.
I was building a library at the time, a file, and I would cut out just about everything and anything, and what and wherever these pictures would I would put them in the categories, and an awful lot of that stuff went into Westerns because I was doing a lot of Westerns. And then, of course, with Hopalong Cassidy, I needed all I could get. But I also had a projector, a sound projector, which I purchased, and I would rent these films. Some of them I would rent from private places in the city that had a lot of these Westerns, like with Glenn Ford. I would watch these films and study the characters and then put them in the Western. And if I had anything in my files that would, like stage coaches and background material and authenticity that would be helpful and create a sense of realism, then I would use that too. My files were just stuff. And to this very day, I still have the same pictures.
Yeah, did you call it an artist morgue?
It's huge.
Was that something common with comic artists at the time, or was
yes.
that?
Yes, I heard that Noel Sickles did it, Kniff did it, they all, Alex Raymond, they all did the same thing.
Well, I find it kind of interesting because your style was always sort of considered one of the first photorealistic styles.
Well, you know, I wanted to get as authentic and believable as I could. And that was my goal. How believable can I get this? How authentic could I get it? And that required an awful lot of work, a lot of time spent at the board, and a lot of, information that I'd either buy a book containing some of these things, or I would happen to have had a picture lying around in my file. Eventually, I grew so large with these pictures, I had to get a cabinet and really file them away. Nice. I started with a shoebox and just throwing the photographs in it, and then eventually it outgrew the shoebox, and then I had to get a filing cabinet. Started with one or two small ones, and eventually, right now I have through the years I've managed to get rid of some of them, but I have two huge cabinets here in my room right now full of stuff, but most of them are dated. You know, they're very dated, very hard to keep up.
Oh, sure.
With what's going on today, and the changes. I have stuff on aircraft carriers, for instance, and fighter aircraft that went along fine with World War II, but that's not the kind of aircraft we have anymore.
Yeah.
But you never know. You know, there might be a story that would crop up dealing with that time in our history, and of course I've got it made then. But if I had kept up, which is a job in itself, then I would have a lot of that. Things are changing so quickly now that whatever you have saved or put away is obsolete tomorrow.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's how it goes.
Be sure to stay inside and listen to AroundComics.com, especially during daylight hours. Seriously, it's spring, and the glint off your pasty white comic geek skin could blind someone.
Well, I find it really interesting that while you're working at DC, there was this guy named Adam Austin who was doing stuff at Marvel that looked exactly like yours.
Because I was working for DC and I was working for Marvel, and I didn't want anyone to know that I was working for the two companies. That thought it would work against me. If Marvel thought or if DC thought that I was getting work from another company.
Sure.
But, you know, like I said, your style, you can't hide it. I don't think there's a lot of stuff there that that can hide it. It's recognizable. So it didn't do me any good. Eventually, I had to just the heck with it. Went back to my. My regular name.
We talked in past shows quite a bit about EC Comics, and they were really one of the first publishers to let their artists sign the work, and they really started to bill the creators. Were you ever a fan of the EC Comics?
Oh, I wanted to really work for them in a very big way. Harvey Kurtzman, I think, was the main editor up there, and he was very innovative. He did a lot of things that, in fact, just about everything he did was never done before. He had, like, sequential art where if you go with five panels in a row, each panel is almost the same as the one before, but there are differences. And so it creates the sense of, like, animation and movement. And that was a great tool for storytelling. You know what I mean?
Sure. You actually did some work for EC, didn't you, at one time?
Eventually, yeah. I wanted to work for Harvey, and he gave me, it was very hard to have him give me anything. I eventually gave me something to do about Wake Island, and I destroyed myself over that because I wanted to impress him, but he didn't like it. I just couldn't get anywhere with him. He was using, Elder, what was his first name, Bob, Jack Elder? Bob Elder.
Oh, Steve Elder.
Inking, Steve John Elder? Severin did a lot of work for them.
Yeah.
Mostly exclusive. He worked exclusively for them, pretty much. I met John, too, and I spoke to him about what can I do to improve myself? I can't seem to get to first base. And, you know, I'm a very easygoing guy, and he gave me a few tips. He said, first of all, he says, get a book. Don't make up any of these weapons, because he's great on, he was very good on weapons and uniforms. He was terrific with that. And so he gave me a lead on some books that I should add to my library, and I did. So all of these things through the years have helped me a lot.
Well, going back a little bit to the late 50s and early 60s, there was the sort of debacle at Timely when Goodman gave up the distributor, and sort of Timely sort of collapsed, and a lot of that work went away. And you were actually sort of out of comics for a few years at that time.
Yeah, the bottom dropped out about 1958. There was a committee against the type of artwork that was put in comic books. Didn't think it was kind of like at the Hayes office that Hollywood had to face every time they made a film to make sure that they did the right thing, that they didn't show anything that was obscene or hurtful. Then, of course, somebody got on a committee and talked against comic books, and that really harmed the business tremendously. And most of Marvel had to give up they had to let a good many artists go. Stan stayed, of course, because he was Martin Goodman's nephew, so he stayed, and not that he couldn't deliver his wonderful idea, great on marketing, and he's a wonderful writer, and Jack Kirby stayed, and between the two of them, they managed to turn out a tremendous amount of books. But they didn't have the money to hire people, so I had to get work elsewhere. I worked for an advertising company, which I hated the job. I floundered around for about 5-6 years until eventually I got work again from Stan. I didn't think it would ever come back, but it did.
Could you tell us a story about, I had read in an interview with you how you were working with DC at that time, like in the early 60s, and you were doing romance comics, and Stan wanted you to come back and work for Marvel. Do you remember that story at all, where he was trying to convince you?
Yeah, I do. I would have come back, but there was no, money is the thing that all artists are interested in. and that was an actual thing, because everyone wants to feel in life that they're getting somewhere. And so I tried to tell him I would be glad to come over to Marvel if you'd, you know, up my page rate. He didn't feel that he had to. He just felt that it wouldn't be necessary, that eventually I'll come back to me. If I didn't want to come back to him today, he'd be getting me tomorrow. I said, well, then in that case, I'll just stay with DC. So the following day, he called me up and told me to come back.
Playing hardball with Stan.
And bluff, which I'm not really good at. I'm not a businessman, but I just got pissed. So I wanted to work with Stan, but if he wasn't going to, you know, up my page rate, if I felt that I needed to feel a sense of getting somewhere, of earning a little more money. I was a family man then, and I needed it, like any artist would. But he didn't want to do anything until he saw that he couldn't frighten me. And, you know, he's a businessman, too, and he didn't want to.
Always the businessman. That's
you ended up outstanding Stan, so that's very...
Well, then, when you did come back to Marvel, that's sort of when you started your first real superhero work? Is that right, on Submariner and
Oh, yeah. I never had a book, I think, until I did come back. I've always wanted a book of my own, and I just never got one. But when I came back, that's when I started to get... I think I got... Daredevil at that time. John Romita did it for a short while, but I was given the opportunity to do it. I really read, you know, and one thing led to another. And even when I did Tomb of Dracula, he didn't want to give that to me. He said I could have it, but then he kind of backed off on it and said that he had really promised it to Bill Everett at the time. And I said, Stan, how could you say that? I remember you telling me that I could have that book, and that's something I am absolutely the artist that you would need for that book. I could put that book across like no one can. I tried to talk him into it, but no. So what I did was I went home. I was in the city speaking to him about it, and I went home and I worked up a sheet of samples of how I thought Dracula should look, and I think I inked it, and then I sent it to him, and he called me immediately. He says, the job is yours. And that's how I got it, and that was 11 or 12 years that I've been working on it with the different writers. Mm-hmm. Eventually, not that long after I started doing it, that Marv Wolfman came along, and we kept that book going a long time.
Now, you chose to leave Daredevil at the time because you really wanted to work on Tomb of Dracula, is that right?
I was actually burning the candles at both ends. I did Tomb of Dracula. I can't remember for sure whether it was exclusive of anything else, but I try to keep my hand on Daredevil as well. I was really working awfully hard, trying to...
Oh, wow.
It was a balancing act to make sure that I wasn't losing out on anything. And that's what happened with Howard the Duck too. The thing was even going to be syndicated. In fact, it was. I couldn't keep up with it. Steve Gerber couldn't keep up with it. We were also doing different books for Marvel, and so the whole thing just fell apart.
Now, whenever you came back, and we had touched on it briefly, but you left comics for a while, but whenever you came back, it was under the Comics Code authority. How different was it being an artist under the Comics Code than pre-Comics Code? Did it really change your job a lot?
No. When I would edit the work myself if I thought that there was something objectionable in what I was doing. I would throw a shadow up on the wall and get my thought across that way. You know, I would do it in such a way that the point was made without actually showing anything that anyone could say that wasn't in good taste. I try to do the work with good taste in mind all the time.
Yeah. Sure, but and I know that the Comics Code was a little overbearing, even even by those days' standards. But did you ever have to go back and change anything that didn't pass the code?
Oh, I mean, changing. Sure, there were a lot of changes from time to time. They never gave me very much trouble with that. But when I worked with DC, I had a lot of problems with that. There was a particular editor, I don't want to mention him, but I had a lot of trouble with him over changes and fixing things up and redoing. I mean, after all, time is important. And he didn't care how much time you spent on a job. If he didn't like it, then you had to go correct it. And sometimes you'd have to correct it again and again and again. And I thought it was just overdone, I had to do it because I didn't want to lose my position there.
Sure.
But to tell you the truth, I did lose my position because I told him one day that I thought he was crazy. And I was out of work for 5-6 years.
Wow.
After doing that, I knew it. I knew once I said it, you can kiss this job goodbye and maybe others as well. That's what happened.
Like locking your keys in your car and you watch the door shut and you're like, oh, God, what is it?
Yeah.
Well, I hope you got your money's worth in that one.
It was also, I couldn't get any work from Marvel, but it was not because of this. The comic book industry was just hanging by a thread. And I got this work from DC, and I stepped out of line. I had to. I just couldn't take it. And that was the result. But I got back in again, believe it or not, 5 or 6 years later. Things calmed down in the industry. There was work again, and I was one of them that got it.
Well, your run on Daredevil was, that was a huge run, almost 100 issues straight. And then you came back in the late 70s, and then again in the 90s, and have done Daredevil.
Yeah.
And I, that's one of those characters that your name is really tied to. Can you talk a little bit about that time spent on that character and what you felt about that character and how...
Yeah, I love doing Daredevil. The fact that he was blind, a blind character, opened up a door for a lot of inspirational things, How would a blind man see? What kind of image could I conjure up to create for the reader, possibly, not being blind, but possibly, what it might be like to be blind. And once in a while that would come up. Not much, but it did. And of course there were many action scenes in it, and I had to choreograph all of them. I got to the point where I said, Stan, is there some other way of telling the story without having him fighting villains and at every issue going through all these acrobatic things, and let's do something different. He said, Gene, that's where the book makes money. That's what the fans want to see. And he was right. He was right. At that time, I had seen, and this was in the 60s, at that time, Bullet came out. And I was so influenced by the car chase scene in that. I'm sure you've seen it.
Sure, absolutely.
That I wanted an opportunity to put it in one of the books. And it did come up. So I used up about 5 or 6 pages in just the car chase scene. I did it in the way that I introduced it into the plot. And I wanted to take the reader for a real wild ride. I was so into this thing. And so I ate up about 5 or 6 pages out of maybe 28-page story. And that's crucial. When you use take that kind of time to use up space for something, as Dan would put it, that you could have done in 2-3 panels, you're not using good sense. He says, why in the world would you take up so much time to show me something that you could have told in just a few panels? Well, I told him the reason. I felt it was a good thing to see. And it turned out that I was right. We got a lot of good... the fans were really pouring in the mail over that one. So that was a great moment in my career.
Well, when you start working on a character like Daredevil or even like Howard the Duck or things like that, when you first start working on it, is it really clear to you that these characters will have staying power? Is it always just sort of...
I worried more about how long I'd be in the business. would my age, as I grew older, if I was still there, would my age reveal the fact that... would my drawings reveal the fact that I'm getting on in years, you know? But, you know, the fans don't see you. They just see your work. So that was my biggest concern. Thank God they don't see, they don't know what I look like. I'm too old. It's just that you have to keep the workbook in young, which I try very hard to do. I was always thinking too, and I did think, where I would wind up if the bottom did drop out. I try not to concentrate on that, too much. It didn't serve any purpose other than to, you know, work me up and I get upset over it, so I figured to heck with it. What happens, happens, you know, but that's why I try to give my very best. I didn't want any of that stuff to happen. And, of course, I wanted to improve all along as an artist. I wanted to just... I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it so much that I really got into it. And it wasn't so good either for family life. You know, your children grow up, and you're always at the board. You might as well be bald and chained there, because you're not with your family much. You're there at home, but you're not around them. You're around them, but you don't spend time with them, is what I'm trying to say. So that's one of the penalties of, you know, being an artist. Whether you're an illustrator or a fine arts painter, artists are generally married to their work.
You just have to train your kids to be inkers so they can sit right
next
to you.
Oh, yeah, I tried that. My son didn't want any part of it. He's an artist and a very good one. No, he didn't want anything to do with comics.
Going back to Daredevil a little bit, I was wondering, did you know, after you left that book, did you have any sense of the legacy that you had left behind with it? And did you pay...
No. No, I was out to impress. I wanted to impress. I didn't care what I put in it and how much work I put into it. If the inker had a problem with it, that would be something that he would have to deal with. Usually I put in half tones and anything else that would come off my pencil. I knew that a lot of it was not really for comic books because I put in these half tones. I inkers, at that time, the printing process was not as sophisticated as it is today. And they couldn't reproduce anything from pencil in. But today they can, and beautifully too. But then they couldn't. And so I should have been more linear. I suppose it would have helped me with my speed as well. But that part of me would creep out all the time. I'd put in lines that the inkers couldn't spend the time bothering with. It would require a lot of line work to create a dull, to create a tone or a shadow effect. If it was not completely black, then I would do it with half tones and lines and crosshatch work to create a half tone. And they didn't want to put that in. You know, it had to be strictly black and white with a minimum of tone.
Was there ever an inker in particular that you really liked that inked over your work?
Oh, yes. Al Williamson.
Oh, all okay. Right,
there we go.
Yeah, I got it. But he's a very fine a penciler. He had a syndicated strip, too, that he was working on for a newspaper. But it got to the point where it just... He didn't enjoy it anymore. He wanted to make his life simpler. He decided to be an anchor. There was another anchor that worked along with all of us in the bullpen. His name was Vince Valesci. I don't know if you know who I mean, but a very fine anchor that inked just about everything Sid did. Sid could do inked himself too, but Vince inked everything. He was not a penciler, but a fabulous anchor. So once in a while, I would get him to ink a story of mine. I didn't have much input as to who would get what. Mm-hmm. And if anybody that I wanted really to ink, if I could possibly get who I really wanted at that time. And, you know, I just simply handed in the work and let them worry about it.
Hi, I'm Simon Oliver, the writer of The Exterminators, and you're listening to Around Comics.
Well, moving on to Howard the Duck, which we all love Howard the Duck. He's turned into a really fun, iconic character in Marvel's history. What was it like working with Steve Gerber?
He's a liar. I read his scripts. I generally don't read scripts through. I would read maybe 5 pages into something, and then I would go ahead and do it. Because, you know, you can pretty well, after years and years of doing this stuff, you can figure out just how this is going to run. There's always a surprise that you didn't count on, but every now and then that'll show up. But I knew when I was on safe ground, and I knew when I wasn't. But I love Steve's work, and I would roar I had to read the script because it was entertaining in itself. He's a very funny guy. He had a take on life like no one that I have read in the comics, you know, had. And they teamed me up with him, and, oh, we had a time and a half. But, you know, eventually it tumbled because neither one of us could keep up with it, and we didn't want to lose out on the other things that we were doing as well. And this act, Howard, really required 100% of your time, and that we couldn't give.
Well, earlier you were talking about sort of the photorealism aspect of it. Was it difficult being sort of confronted with a book? And Howard the Duck's one of my favorite books of all time.
Well, Howard's all like an animated character.
Yeah.
But Beverly and the other people around him were not. Of course, some of the villains, like Bong.
Yeah, Radish Man.
Some of the others were sort of animated, too. But there was a sense of realism about them. You could tell it was a guy dressed up with a big bell on his head. But Howard was strictly a Donald Duck character. I'm surprised at first. I was very surprised that Walt Disney didn't climb all over Marvel because of it. But eventually they did, not in any great way, and they just wanted Marvel to put pants on Howard. Have him just waddle around, you know, with his feathers sticking out. So that was about the only criticism that they had.
Well, I have the essential Howard the Duck in front of me, and the reprints of the black and whites look just fantastic. And this actually came up from someone in our on our forum. It asked about what you thought about your Marvel work being reprinted, like, in black and white, because a lot of people seem to really enjoy the just non-colored versions of your books.
Oh, yes. Well, a lot of the work that the inkers did on Howard, one or two particular inkers, I can't remember their names, but they did great work on it. They even used airbrush on some of the artwork to get a nice tonal effect, a sweeping tonal effect, smooth effect. Today they do it on a computer, which is a great way to do it. I wouldn't want to work that way. If I can't lay my hands on it, if I have to rely upon a gadget of some sort to do the coloring or the inking for me, that takes the art out of it. To me, it would. You know, there are so many methods today. If Rembrandt could have gotten a hold of a camera, he would have used it. I do. I mean, it was a great tool. And it's used extensively by illustrators and probably painters. I don't know about painters, but if they're in the school of realism, yes. But not so much of it as modern art and interpretive art and stuff. They don't need a camera. But most of the illustrators and painters use cameras to some extent. And today with the computer, the artists now are using the computer to color the work, and it looks great, and I must say it really does. But the joy of penciling for me would be gone, you know, if I had to simply use a computer and not bother to flesh it out with a pencil.
Is there anything in sort of the modern sort of array of tools that people use that you wish you could have had in 1960?
No.
Nice.
Who needed them? Who needs them?
I was really living in my own world. Still am. I just, I know what I want to do, and I head straight for it. I got from the Art Students League, I got what I wanted out of it. I wanted to learn anatomy, and I did, to some extent. You know, a lot of it is just by experience, and wherever you can get your source from, it's fine. I taught at the SVA, I taught at the Fashion Institute of Technology here for a while, FIT, but it's got to come from the gut. The artist should try to personally improve himself and not rely on, see that when I bring up computers, I think that's relying on something that I find turns me off personally. So I wouldn't know how to use it anyway. I mean, I would have to first go. I don't even know how to work the computer, to tell you the truth. I can turn it on, I can turn it off, and that's about as far as I go. My wife knows the inside out of a computer, but I can't. I don't know how to really get into the technical stuff of the computer and how to get to different places. I can write a letter on it, but that's about all.
Well, you had said earlier that you're a big fan of movies. I was wondering, have you seen any of the movies that they've made out of these various characters that you worked on, like Daredevil or Howard the Duck?
Blade. Yeah, I saw Blade, and I walked out on it. The first one. Because they went over the top. All stops were pulled out, and they didn't care what they put up there. And I don't think that's in good taste. You know, I feel that when you tell a story, it's not so much what you can see. It's more telling and more effective of what you can't see. When they show all the blood and everything like that and the horror of it, it would be far better if they just suggested it. That's how I feel. I found it in bad taste, and I didn't want to, I didn't want to see any more of it. So I know they made several different.
They didn't get any better, so you didn't miss anything.
No.
Did you happen to see Daredevil or Howard the Duck?
I didn't like Daredevil either. Only I didn't think that they. I don't think that they put their best foot forward.
You weren't the only one.
They could have done a lot better.
You're not alone in that.
Assessment. Too much in shadow. Just didn't ring. I see. Spider-Man. They went to town with that one, and it's extremely popular. It's one of their best sellers.
Oh yeah.
And they've made many many sequels to Spider-Man.
Did I think I read somewhere that you were actually in a movie once. Is that true?
I was in a film very briefly with Eric Roberts called The Ambulance. Originally, the title was Up in Smoke, but they had to rename it The Ambulance for some reason. Stan was in it, and Red Buttons was in it, and James Earl Jones was there. So it was more of a big joy for me to meet these guys. Otherwise, I never would have met these people. You know, and you get to speak to them when the cameras weren't going. It's interesting to even see how they make a movie. They go to such trouble. to create a scene. It's fabulous to watch. So I was just way in the background there were other people there in the bullpen. You know, we were all in the bullpen. That was part of the story. Eric Roberts was a comic book artist. And the plot starts with that. And they needed my work to imitate to give the impression that Eric Roberts did it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to draw certain scenes that were in the film that Eric Roberts was supposed to have done. So we were in a makeup chair. He was sitting next to me. I was in one chair, and he was another, and I was I was supposed to be him, but I was older, and I was afraid my hands wouldn't photograph as a younger person, so they put some makeup on my hands and to kind of smooth out the wrinkles, so that's how I got into it. That's what I did. And I enjoyed it tremendously.
Nice.
Larry Cohn was the director. He's done other things.
Going back to Blade, a lot of people don't know that you and Marv Wolfman actually created that character.
Yeah, we did. We didn't get anything out of it, though. I wish we had.
Well, we have
that's what I used to say.
No, we have a question from one of our listeners. Stephen Aaron wants to know. He's fascinated to know what you think of comics at the moment and what, if any, comics you're reading.
I don't read them. I'm busy right now doing illustrations on commissions. You know, the fans will write to me and ask me to do a commission for them, and they'll say, I want a full-length shot of Captain America doing something, or just a bust shot, just a headshot of him. Those are the requests I get. And sometimes I get a request that show three or four of these figures in one illustration. One of them was with Dracula and myself. I'm even in it, and a Daredevil and another character, one of the superheroes. We're all in a library. A kind of an old library, and I'm poring over some books and pointing out something, and Dracula is standing behind me and pointing at the book. So that was a very extensive piece of work on a large board that I did. You know, I was commissioned for it. I did something of pirates that I never did anything like that in my life in comics or anywhere else. Someone, you know, they paid me for it, and so I had to cut it somewhere. I began to dig up information on how pirates look, how, you know, how they dress, and old ships. I got involved with that, and eventually the whole thing came together, and I spent a lot of time with that. And that was a big piece. So some of them are very big, some of them are very small. And that's what I generally do. I'm doing right now a Captain America book for Marvel. I haven't worked with them in a long time.
Tell us a little bit about that. How far along are you on that, and how's it been working with Ed Brubaker?
Oh, he's a wonderful guy. I speak to him every now and then as to what I don't understand. He fills me in on a lot of stuff. Very, very easygoing fellow. He's wonderful. I wish they were all as good as that. But I'm enjoying it. You know, it's hard to get back into sequential art again, you know, telling a story. But as pages go by, I find it gets easier and easier. By the time I get to the third or fourth page, I'm into it. I did something for the Simpson character.
Mm-hmm.
I did, 12, 13 pages of that. Of the Simpsons.
You did the, didn't you do an escapist book not too long ago?
I did that, yes, mm-hmm. For Dark Horse.
Right.
So here and there, different things crop up. But I'm enjoying myself with what I do, and if I live long enough, maybe I can do something, a real departure from comics.
How do you feel about having a U.S. Postal stamp?
Oh, my God, who would have ever think that it would ever come to that? But it's hard to believe. It really is. And that's going to come out in July,
mm-hmm.
And I think it's just a wonderful thing that's happened, really. But there were other artists, too, you know, that John Buscema got one. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. He's not around now to enjoy that, but his family is. And some of the other artists, I've enjoyed that privilege of having their work eventually wind up on the back of a stamp. I'd rather be on a stamp than up on the wall in the post office.
That's right.
I suppose if you're going to be in the post office, that's the best to be.
Hi, I'm Ed Brubaker. When I'm not waiting for the trade, I like to listen to a Round Comics podcast.
You had mentioned it before how your art you always felt, you know, wasn't necessarily right for comics because you had put so much work into the pencils and inkers, you know, had a hard time replicating your work. But then later on, you had done Nathaniel Dusk and the other one was Ragamuffins. And those were taken straight from your pencil work. Because
they were, but by that time, the printing presses were had changed the what they could print, what they couldn't print, had changed tremendously. Most of it was they could pick up anything at that time from pencil and make it look like someone had come along and inked it. So that's how it all started, and my work looks best in that form. I discovered that my work looks best in that form.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, you have two different styles working on the same piece.
Well, I'll tell anyone that's listening, if you haven't seen Gene's work, his straight pencil commissions, go to his website. It's genecolin.com and look at his gallery of pencil commissions, and it's absolutely amazing. The straight from pencil work of yours is just gorgeous, and any of those commissions are worth every single penny because they're amazing work.
Thank you so much for that.
And now you had announced earlier this year that you were retiring from doing commissions.
Yeah, I wanted to retire. I wanted to make sure that I could afford to retire.
Sure.
So far it has not worked out. It would require an awful lot of fans. In fact, I mean, the fans were great. They keep asking me to do stuff, and I just can't keep up with it. They eventually get their work, but it hasn't worked out in actuality like I thought it might. So I'm still working at it.
I was going to say you're the busiest. You're the busiest retired guy I've ever seen.
Yeah, I know. But I try. I'm trying to maneuver myself into a position where I don't have to do it.
Yeah, we of course want to see you retire happy, but at the same time, we don't want to see you stop working either.
Well, who knows where I'll wind up? Hopefully, I don't think it'll ever be in the movies, but I do think that maybe I can get into the fine arts. I have some ideas about fine arts. I'd like to give it a shot.
One thing I do want to ask you about, and we had talked about The Essentials and had touched on Tomb of Dracula. Now, recently in the fourth volume of that, they had to go back and work over some of the pages on there to cover up some exposed breasts so it wouldn't have a mature reader's title. Did you have a problem with them altering your artwork for the reprints of that?
No. I've seen that happen many, many times. But I never concerned myself much with it. They felt that there was a need to do it. And to me it would be like whistling in the wind to try to get them to change it. It didn't bother me. So they changed it. So I moved on. I'm not making an issue over it. Once I did it, they owned it.
Mm-hmm.
Long it was in my hands, I owned it. When I got out of my hands and I handed it over to them, they could do whatever they wanted with it. And that's how I looked at it. I was always trying to do something that I thought the editor would like to see and the fans would like to see.
Sure.
If I could get it past the editor, then I was just always hoping that the fans would then appreciate what I've done. A lot of my stuff tends to look a little on the confusing side. But then I look at life that way. When you see on the screen something that's not all that clear, I find there's a good reason for it. If you're, and I've mentioned this before in other interviews, when you see, for instance, a fight scene in a dark room, well, you can't identify the figures on the screen. You know that there's an awful lot of stuff going on. But who belongs to what leg or what arm? People are flying over desks and chairs. the contents of what's on the disc goes flying. You can identify it, and that's just great, because you can't, not even in real life would you be able to see. And it adds to the drama of the piece.
Sure. I mean, not everything is going...
Well...
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
If you can't identify what you're looking at, all the better. That's how I feel, because life is like that. At times, I try to imitate life. I try to do whatever I can to be as realistic as I can, and as far as I can take it. And if it means doing something that isn't all that clear or sharp where it's so easy to tell what's going on, all the better. That's how I look at it. Right or wrong, I do it that way. That's the way it is.
Well,
I can't change now.
It's too late. Too late now. Forget it.
Too late, yeah. It is.
In 2005, you were inducted into the Will Eisner Hall of Fame. Could you tell us a little bit about how that felt and what that experience was like?
I was out in San Diego with my wife. At a convention. To me, it was a convention. They wanted me to say, I was ready to go home a little bit earlier because we had worked very hard at the convention hall and I thought the whole thing was over. But there was a woman running it who told me no. She said, you can't go home now. And I said, why not? And she said, well, it's important that you stay. She wouldn't tell me what it was. And I didn't have any idea what it was that she wanted me to stay. And then, of course, I got into along with other artists, into the Eisner Award dinner, or whatever the function at night.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter was there, too. And it came up on the screen. They were showing the work of all the artists through the years. And then my name came up, and I thought I'd die. I could. They were stringing me along, and they knew all along that I had was going to get an award, and I had not an inkling of it. I had no idea that it was going to be anything like that. So I'm very proud of the fact that I got it. It was a wonderful experience to have been there, to have been able to get up there and give a little talk about my career and to the people that I'm grateful to. I've been in a long time, you know. How many years now? 50-some-odd years.
I think you're at 60 years. 60 years.
Right.
One hell of a career.
Yeah.
Yeah, a long time. A lot of staying power, thank God.
And still doing it.
Some of the artists dropped out. Bernie Kriegstein, I think, was one of them. He dropped out. Some others, I don't know, maybe he came back in again for a while. Most of them stayed, but there were a few dropouts. It's a tough business. But I can't think of a business that isn't. You want to make a mark for yourself in the world, it takes plenty of work. You've got to love it, though. You've just got to love. Whatever you do, you have to love. That, to me, is the secret of success.
That's probably the one common thread I've found with all the creators that we've talked to and met, is that they all love the industry. They love the work. And I think you're right. I think you have to love it to do it.
They have to love it. No matter what, they'd rather do. They'd work for nothing. They would... You know, like an actor struggling to get somewhere. I'll do the part for nothing. You know, let me just get me in the film. I'd work for nothing. And that's how artists are.
Well, looking back at it, Gene, would you have done it any differently?
I probably wouldn't be in the business. I would probably have gone, if I had it to do again, I might have made an attempt to get into movies, but not as an actor. Who knows at what... In what capacity I would have gotten into it. I've always been interested in film. But I wouldn't have had the fortitude for it. From what I see that they go through, you have to have some pretty hard-head boy and stamina to be able to withstand that kind of buffeting around. I don't think I would have been able to take it. It's too difficult. Then if I say that, then I have to say... In the next breath, and if that's how I felt, then I probably wouldn't like it as much as I should have. you know, if I really like the business, then you just hang in and do the best you can, you know. But hanging, so many people have, you know, to the rest of their days, they would hang in, and there's a lot of actors are still doing it.
Well, hey, Gene, you know, there was one other question I had for you. You've been called Gentleman Gene the Dean.
Everything in the book.
You got more nicknames than Apollo Creed. How did you get all these nicknames?
I don't know. I think Stan might have started it.
Stan kept coming up with them?
I think so, yeah. He called me Gene the Dean. There might have been others. That's the one that's outstanding in my mind. Mm-hmm. He called me that, and Sam was wonderful. And I still speak to him.
Oh, that's wonderful.
You know, a lot of people you can call today, and they won't call you back. You can take it to the bank. If you make a call to Stan, he'll answer it. He'll call you back.
Wow. Are you looking forward to possibly meeting up with him in New York in late February?
Oh yes, I'd love to see him again. Sure, I would. It's been a long time since I've seen Stan.
Yeah, he's...
I sure would.
He's out on the West Coast now.
He's eternally youthful.
The boy, he's always been the boy.
Very youthful guy. And is he going strong? He's 83, and is he going strong? Boy, oh boy.
Eternally young.
Yes, he is.
Are you going to be... you're going to be at the New York Comic Con in February, correct?
Yes, I am.
Are you going to be doing any type of work there? Are you going to be doing sketches at all? Or?
Oh, yeah, I'll be at the table. I have a table. I'll be there. I'll be sketching.
We will be there.
I am going to get a... I have to get a Gene Colan sketch from you.
I'll be glad to.
Fantastic.
Oh, wonderful.
We will see you then.
I want to thank you, fellas, for interviewing me. It's been a pleasure to get to be on the air.
Oh, Mr.
Thank you so much.
Mr. Colan, the pleasure is all ours.
It's really an honor.
Oh, the honor is absolutely ours.
Thank you.
We're huge fans of your work. We really appreciate all the hard work and all the time that you've put into making comics and really creating and developing these characters that we've all fallen in love with. And we just really want to thank you for taking time, you know, out and talking with us.
I've enjoyed every bit of it. Oh. I could have been here all night. I really could have. I've enjoyed it.
Well,
I
tell you what, maybe we can have you back in the near future.
Anytime.
We would love to talk to you again.
Thanks again.
All right.
Well, we'll see you in February, Gene. And,
okay.
And otherwise, have a good night, and thanks
you
again.
Too.
And thank you to Gene Colan for being, you know, such a, first of all, wonderful person, and for spending some time with us this evening.
It's, I can see where he got the moniker, Gentleman Gene. He certainly was that. And
he was the Dean.
The Dean!
The Deaner! The Dean.
He was great. That was fantastic.
Gene the Dean.
We have a couple posts that were sent in that I think epitomize how a lot of fans think him. This first one is from Wayne Osborne. And he says that he had no question in particular, but he says, please express our thanks for many years of entertainment. From the heroism of Daredevil to the horror of Dracula, his unique style brought power and movement to the page that I had never seen before and have rarely seen since. He is one of the greats.
No question.
And I think Vince B., our good buddy from the Bullpen Bulletins podcast, who is a huge fan, he says, I want to thank Gene for providing me with some of the most vivid and comforting memories of my childhood. When I look at Gene's work, I instantly recall those long summer afternoons on my back porch reading Gene's Captain Marvel, Iron Man, Doctor Strange, Howard the Duck, he says, my favorite, and countless others. No small feat to have your work ingrained in the minds of your audience for 30-plus years. My life would not be the same had Gene never picked up a pencil. He's a true magician. Love you, Gene.
Good thing he didn't go into that acting career.
Yeah. Well, I mean, is it that great to ingrain your work into the mind of someone who's obviously disturbed?
What kind of effect did Gene Colan
have? What did that twist twisted him?
Love you,
congratulations.
Vince.
That's a true point. Yeah.
So it's what a pleasure to talk with him, and really a true gentleman. So thank you, Gene Colan. All right, guys, let's wind this one down. We have a few announcements here. Want to talk about Shopping Around Comics?
Shopping Around Comics, www.aroundcomics.com. You can buy Around Comics gear at our Cafe Press store, or you can buy comic trades, books, CDs, DVDs, whatever you want from Amazon.com at our Amazon store.
And we'll get some Gene Colan stuff in there the store this week.
Some essentials.
You can spread the Around Comics love. You can print out our listener LCS challenge flyer from the homepage and ask your local comic shop manager or owner if they would be so kind as to display that in their shop. If they do so, we will mention them on the show and put a link to their shop on the site. You can also vote for us at Podcast Alley. We always appreciate that. And my personal favorite, the iTunes music review, Be As Cool As Andy Parks.
The only thing I wanted to add something to the spread the AC love. If you go onto Google and you search for how to make a stencil, I would suggest you make a stencil of our thing and if you find someone sleeping on the streets, tag them with it.
Sure.
I want to see someone. I want to see a crazy street person with an Around Comics.
Nice, Tom. Jacket.
So I'll send all the hate mail.
And, send all the hate mail to me.
Speaking of podcasts and Andy Parks, I don't mention it enough. If you haven't checked out the Will Flipson show, please do so. It is a very funny and very entertaining podcast, and Andy always has a little bit of content on there. He does some great voices on that show. Want to mention our website, www.aroundcomics.com. You can check out all the great things that Around Comics has to offer. It's your source for the best in comic book news, reviews, and opinions. While you're there, please take a minute to fill out our listener survey. It lets us know who we're talking to and how we can make Around Comics a better show.
I wanted to mention also we have a couple of things that changed on the website this week.
We stopped letting
people post in the lab forum, only because it seemed like that forum was getting kind of ignored, and there was some really cool stuff in there, so I moved a bunch of those threads to the main forum and just closed down the lab. So
I just felt intimidated because I'm not an artist.
Well,
you know, or a writer.
People are creepy, too.
So, feel free to post any of that stuff that you would have posted before in the lab, just post it in the main forum, and we'll just keep doing that stuff. And also, the other thing on the site, we have a new contest that we started to last week, and it's a trivia contest, movie challenge trivia. So we're going to run that through the end of January, and the top three
will win some stuff.
You'll get some stuff. You'll get some of it.
I would like to thank the New York Comic Con for sponsoring this episode. Also like to thank Sal and Tom, as always. You guys did a great job. Everyone, have a fantastic rest of your week.
Where are we?
Thanks, boss.
Okay.
We'll be back again next Monday with another new episode. In the meantime, we'll be everywhere in
and around comics.
Finding where I am.
Finding Tom lost once again.
Like to suggest a topic? Send us your comments or are interested in becoming a panel member? Email us at info@aroundcomics.com or visit the Contact Us section of our website. Music for the show provided by the Podshow Podsafe Music Network. Music.podshow.com. Views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and do not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Thank you for listening today, and remember to join us next time when the panel will change, but our mission will stay the same. Bringing you the very best news, reviews, and opinions in and around comics. Around Comics is a Pipe Dream production. Copyright 2006. All rights reserved. Love you, babe. Yeah. Why you got my love and left me alone? Why you got my left alone? I know that you don't love me. Baby, love you one more time.